From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It's Hollywood's blockbuster season, but one of the films that's really caught on is a low-budget independent comedy called Chasing Amy, a love story that's been described as boy meets lesbian. On today's Fresh Air, we'll meet the writer and director Kevin Smith, who also directed Clerks and Mallrats. And we'll hear from Richard Russo, author of a new comic novel about life in the English department of a small college campus. One of Russo's earlier novels, Nobody's Fool, was adapted into a movie starring Paul Newman. Now they're collaborating on a new film. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Supreme Court has handed down several decisions today. In one, the justices struck down the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. The case involved a Catholic church that wanted to expand its sanctuary in a historic part of a small Texas town. The ruling will probably now make it harder to claim that some government actions improperly restrict religious freedom. In another case, the High Court refused to revive a $1.3 billion asbestos settlement. The money would have resolved hundreds of thousands of injury claims against asbestos makers. The settlement would also have precluded all future claims against the firms, even by people who may not be ill from asbestos contamination yet. French oceanographer Jacques Cousteau has died at the age of 87. A massive tribute for him will be held in Paris. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
Jacques Cousteau died today, according to a statement by his foundation in Paris. For months, news reports have said that he was ill. The oceanographer had remained active until last year, fighting against marine pollution and even against French nuclear testing in the South Pacific. He was one of the most popular men in France, and probably the best-known Frenchman abroad, thanks to his U.S. television series, The Undersea World of Jacques Cousteau. Cousteau spent 60 years plying the seas, mainly in his boat Calypso. Besides being an oceanographer, he was also an inventor. He co-invented the Aqualung, developed a one-man jet-propelled submarine, and helped start the first manned colony undersea. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
NASA is evaluating the extent of damage done to the Russian space station Mir, which collided with a supply ship today. Pat Duggins of member station WMFE reports.
An unmanned space capsule called a Progress vehicle rammed Mir this morning. NASA says a solar power panel was damaged and crew members had to close off one compartment due to a drop in air pressure. NASA astronaut Michael Fole and the two cosmonauts on board Mir are reported to be safe following the accident. There's a Soyuz space capsule attached to Mir for the crew to use as an escape craft if needed. The three men were watching the Progress vehicle fly on remote control. It later bumped into one of Mir's science modules. Mir has been plagued with problems this year, including a fire and the breakdown of critical life support equipment. A manned Soyuz spacecraft bumped into Mir back in 1992, causing no damage. The space shuttle isn't scheduled to visit Mir again until the fall. For National Public Radio, I'm Pat Duggins reporting.
A hearing is underway for Sergeant Major Gene McKinney, the Army's top enlisted man, on charges of sexual misconduct. McKinney is accused by four women. The charges include indecent assault, adultery, and obstruction of justice. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 29.5 points at 7,787. The NASDAQ is up 5.5 points at 1,457. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market has advanced to record levels. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
Today's advance is being powered by technology stocks. Motorola rallied after Smith Barney raised its price targets on telecommunication shares. Semiconductor stocks gained when Micron Technology was recommended at Merrill Lynch. And computer software issues moved higher after Lehman Brothers reiterated its buy opinion on Oracle Corp. On an otherwise up day, the most active issue in the NASDAQ market has lost more than 60%. Shares in Liposome Company tumbled after the release of disappointing results in tests of the company's new respiratory drug. I'm Doug Krisner.
A real estate trade group says home resales figures for May are at their third highest level on record. The National Association of Realtors says the resales are up 4.4% from April. The realtors expressed surprise that sales of existing homes did not fall slightly. New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani has threatened a boycott of Continental Airlines over an ad campaign that he says demeans his city. The ads try to lure passengers away from New York's LaGuardia and Kennedy airports to nearby Newark International Airport in New Jersey. Mayor Giuliani says the method used to promote the ad demeans New York. Continental Chairman Gordon Bethune sent a letter to the mayor saying the carrier would change one radio spot, but he refused to apologize for promoting Continental's Newark service. Again on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 29.5 points at 7,787. Trading is heavy. The Nasdaq Composite Index is up 5.5 points at 1,457. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from this and other NPR member stations. Contributors include Wellington Management Company, providing investment advice to clients worldwide.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The comedy Chasing Amy is having a long run at the box office. Film critic Roger Ebert called it the best-written film he'd seen in a while. Our film critic John Powers called it the year's best love story. It offers a twist on the classic boy-meets-girl story. This girl that the boy falls in love with is a lesbian. Chasing Amy is set in the world of comic books. Ben Affleck and Jason Lee star as Holden and Banky, best friends who collaborate on a comic. Joey Lauren Adams is Alyssa, the woman and comic book artist Holden falls in love with. In this scene, Holden and Alyssa are driving, and he can no longer pretend he's content with just being friends.
Why are we stopping?
Because I can't take this.
Can't take what?
I love you.
Love me.
I love you. And not in a friendly way. Although I think we're great friends. And not in a misplaced affection puppy dog way. Although I'm sure that's what you'll call it. I love you. Very, very simple. Very truly. You are the epitome of everything I have ever looked for in another human being. And I know that you think of me as just a friend, and crossing that line is the furthest thing from an option you would ever consider, but I had to say it. I can't take this anymore. I can't stand next to you without wanting to hold you. I can't look into your eyes without feeling that longing you only read about in trashy romance novels. I can't talk to you without wanting to express my love for everything you are. And I know this will probably queer our friendship, no pun intended. But I had to say it. So I've never felt this way before.
My guest is the writer and director of Chasing Amy, Kevin Smith. His first feature, Clerks, was a no-budget movie about young guys who work at a convenience store and video store. It was a very successful independent film, so successful that his next film, Mallrats, was made with a studio. But that was a critical and commercial flop. Smith returned to the independent world for Chasing Amy, and he also returned to one of the themes of Clerks, a guy who can't accept that his girlfriend had an adventurous sexual life before they met. In Chasing Amy, Holden can accept that Alyssa has slept with other women, but not that she slept with other men. I asked Kevin Smith how a girlfriend's sexual past became a recurring theme.
Because my girlfriend had sex with other people. And I don't know. It's just always been kind of present. I think it was being raised Catholic has something to do with it. And it's also that unfair double standard, you know, that you're raised with as a male. And it's not the kind of thing that's learned or imparted, actually. I think it's more learned. Like, my father never sat me down and said, son, you know, you want to go to bed with a whore and wake up with a virgin. But it's the kind of thing that, as a guy, you're just grown up thinking and taught, and it's all around you. The idea of, like, you know, you want to be with somebody who hasn't been with anybody or something like that. And I think it has a lot to do with the compare-contrast thing. You know, you just don't want to be graded against somebody else. And, you know, really small-minded thinking like that. And I think, I was raised in the suburbs. I was raised in a real small tri-town area. Everybody knew everybody. So the idea of dating somebody that somebody else you know or somebody in your class has dated was always really unappetizing because, you know, those people could walk up to you in the hall in school and be like, how is she? You know, I'll tell you how she was for me and stuff like that. Real... real nasty, negative guy type, young guy type stuff. And I think when you continue to live in that environment, you don't break away from it. You know, if you go out into the real world and hear varying different viewpoints and opinions and attitudes and stuff like that, you can get away from that kind of thinking. But if you live in that same area you've dwelled in your whole life, it's tough to break free from that. So I think it popped up in the work a lot. I think this is the last time you'll actually see it, though, in a flick I do. I mean, I've said all I can say about dealing with somebody else's past.
You know, it struck me that you grew up at a time when it was pretty typical to have sex while you were still in high school. Mm-hmm. And there maybe weren't limits in the way there were for, like, earlier generations.
Oh, probably not. I mean, it was a real free time. You know, I remember girls coming in to class in the morning after being out at the beach all night, you know, on a Wednesday night or something like that. And that was, at the time, it was kind of shocking. I was just like, well, you know, my God, I can't believe Debbie would do that kind of thing or something like that. But yeah, it was a real free time then, I think, you know, and I imagine it's much more free now. I'm sure people are having sex much younger than even when I was in high school, and that's not that long ago.
Now, the leading female character in Chasing Amy is a lesbian, but she discovers that Holden is her soulmate. So she's, mm-hmm. she's willing to love him in spite of the fact that she still considers herself gay. And there's actually been some controversy about whether you're seeing lesbians from a male heterosexist angle. In fact, there was even, I don't know if you saw this yet or not, but there was two letters in the New York Times Arts and Leisure section on Sunday about it.
Really?
Yeah. You want me to quote one to you?
I'd love to hear it.
Okay, ready?
Okay.
This is in response to an article by Terry Teachout recently in the Times, in which he said that he saw Chasing Amy as a parable about grace, a religious state of grace.
Uh-huh.
And he loved the film.
Yeah, oh, that was real. I love that piece. It was probably the best piece ever written on anything I've ever done.
Okay, so here's a letter protesting.
Right.
And the letter says, Terry Teachout contends that Alyssa, a promiscuous lesbian turned heterosexual monogamist, has been moved by a power greater than that of earthly love, grace. A better answer is that Alyssa has been moved by the power of male fantasy.
Right.
Despite a few random references to Christ in the movie, Alyssa's, quote, conversion, unquote, should be attributed to the fact that she is the protagonist of a patriarchal fairy tale in which the undesirous and self-sufficient female, caught in the power of male seduction, sees the light and wants to give herself to him forever.
Right.
Do you hear a lot about this?
Of course. I don't think with a movie like this, you wouldn't hear. You know, there's no chance you can escape that. And I think we were kind of prepared from that from the beginning. It's always, as much as one could prepare themselves, though, it is always shocking because that's never the intention. Like that's I didn't make that movie. I didn't make the movie you just described in that letter. That's not the movie I made. The thing that really bothers me about it is, like, they contend it's a male fantasy. The other one I'm fond of hearing is it's a 16-year-old boy's fantasy, or it's words to that effect. And it just kills me because, I mean, if it is a 16-year-old boy's fantasy, where's all the rampant nudity? Where's all the wonderful, you know, close-ups of women getting it on with women or something like that? You know, the movie, it was never conceived that way. It didn't come from that place. You know, I'm not one of these guys that's a real big, like, yeah, I want to see two chicks together kind of guy. You know, that's not my fantasy. It's not the thing I think about when I'm alone in a room at night. You know, it's just that it really doesn't appeal to me. I think it's great. I think, you know, it's just what people do, but it's not something that fuels my engine, doesn't turn me on. The thing I always feel about the character of Alyssa and you know, when people take me on for, like, saying, you know, I'm saying this about lesbians. I'm not, you know, I made a movie about one character, one person, one lesbian. I'm not speaking for the whole nation. God, I would never even try. I mean, first off, I'm not even a woman. Second off, I'm not gay. And third off, I'm not a gay woman. So, you know, why would I take on, you know, why would I speak for the entire community? I'm speaking for one character, Alyssa. And, you know, if you don't see yourself reflected in that character, that's fine.
That said, did you have any lesbian friends that you showed the screenplay to and said, you know, what do you think? Does this ring true to you?
Absolutely. I have a very, very dear friend who happens to be a lesbian. Her name is Guinevere Turner, and she wrote Go Fish a couple years ago, and she was in it and stuff. And she actually appears in the movie. And a lot of people were under the misconception that the movie was based on her and I or something, that I'd fallen in love with Gwen at one point. And it's totally not true. It was actually appeared in a Village Voice review by Jim Hoverman. He talked about, you know, that was the basis for the movie, and so not true. Anyway, she's a very good friend of mine. And when I was done, of course, I was like, Gwen, I really need you to proofread this, more or less. I mean, a lot of this stuff is extrapolation. A lot of this stuff is me kind of putting myself in that position and saying, this is how I imagine I would feel if I was gay, if I was a woman, that kind of thing. Even in the case of like Cooper, if I was black, you know, it's a lot of extrapolation in there. So I said, could you please just check it out, make sure there's nothing too far off the mark or nothing that sounds like, yes, there's a guy writing this woman's dialogue. And with the exception of one thing, you know, it was completely on for her. She was like, no, this is true. And I said, do you think it's really going to make people mad? And she said, within the community, she said, yeah, there's no doubt. She said, but, you know, it's really going to make them mad because it's true. It happens. The story happens. A lot of us, like, wind up going back with guys. You know, I can't tell you how many people I know that would, like, wind up going back with a guy or something like that. And nobody in the community wants to see that portrayed on film, let alone by a man, let alone by a straight man. She's going, so of course you're leaving yourself open, you know, to get kind of smacked down. But she's going, it doesn't make it invalid, you know, and it's a good movie. And then I had spoken to her for a while after, since we shot the movie. And I just hung out with her the other day for a while, and she had seen the flick. And, you know, I was kind of worried that maybe she didn't dig on it after she saw it put together or, you know, after hearing a lot of criticism. But she really enjoyed the movie, loved it. And I said, well, what's the feeling within the community? And she said, well, you know, I think your average lesbian doesn't care, thinks it's funny, and probably to some degree identifies with it. She said the more academic lesbian thinks you're the Antichrist.
My guest is Kevin Smith. He wrote and directed Chasing Amy, which is currently in theaters. His earlier films are Clerks and Mallrats. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Kevin Smith, he wrote and directed Chasing Amy, Clerks, and Mallrats.
Another issue that I think you deal with in a very humorous way is the idea of male bonding. Is it really latent homosexuality?
Right.
And this is the kind of question that, you know, film critics and academics and other people ask all the time of male bonding films. And so you have a very funny scene that relates to that. And I'm wondering if that, in a way, is a kind of comic answer to the question of latent homosexuality in male bonding films.
It's to some degree, yeah. I mean, I've always found it really interesting. I mean, the thing is, every relationship has a sexual aspect to it. I don't care if you're gay or straight. And when you're talking about like characters like Holden and Banky, which to me are, of course, my ideal fantasy characters, I mean, I'm not somebody who's grown up with somebody as a friend their whole life. Like, I've switched friends every few years, and the friends I grew up with as a child, I don't really have anymore. I've had the same set of friends for, like, close to 10 years, but I never grew up with them. So, you know, a writer kind of writes their ideal world, and in my ideal world, I grew up with one guy, you know, my whole life, and we've been friends since The Sandbox. So, of course, I get to play that out in film. But the thing is, in a relationship like that, if these guys have been together for 25 years or however long they've known each other, that relationship functions very much like a marriage. You know, it's a marriage without the sex. You know, they kind of bicker. They love each other very much. You know, they're very familiar. They live with each other. The only thing that's missing is that sexual aspect. And, you know, it's missing because perhaps neither of them are gay. But I mean, or have instincts like that, or feel, or, you know, any inclination like that. But it doesn't mean that there's not a kind of sexual component to that relationship.
The main characters in Chasing Amy are comic book artists.
Mm-hmm.
How serious about comics were you as a kid?
As a kid, not very. Just, you know, I mean, they were something to read and you know, casual and kind of fun and escapist. Not very hardcore. I mean, I did keep them in the bags you're supposed to keep them in. But then I fell out of it for a long time and didn't get back into them again until I was about 17, almost 18. And by that time, comics had changed. We had people like Alan Moore who came in and wrote The Watchmen, and Frank Miller who had redefined Batman with The Dark Knight Returns and brought a very psychological edge to comics that had never been there before, and they had taken a jump. They had become very adult, you know, for lack of a better word. So I really got into them knee-deep, and it's since that time I've been into them pretty hardcore.
Yeah, I think you even just bought a comic book store in New Jersey in Red Bank, really?
I did. I mean, that was the, you know, I always figured, like, when I was done with the filmmaking career, I'd kick back and go back to retail, and I couldn't do the convenience store anymore. I'd just done too much of that throughout my life, so I figured I would own a comic book store. And then an opportunity presented itself even quicker. Our former comics retailer was leaving town, and the store was going to be vacant And we would have had to travel about 5-10 minutes to go get our comics every week. So I said, forget it. I'll just buy the store in town and, you know, we'll redub it. And now it's Jay and Silent Bob's Secret Stash.
In your movie Chasing Amy, there's a funny scene in which two of the characters are arguing about the real meaning of the Archie comics. Mm-hmm. And the gay character is arguing that this was a real, like, male bonding as gay kind of story. And Banky, who's the one of the comic book artists who's very heterosexual, says, no, this is all about chasing girls.
Right.
Let me play an excerpt of their conversation together.
Okay.
Archie and the Riverdale gang were a pure and fun-loving bunch. You can't find dysfunction in those comics. They were just flat-out wholesome.
Archie and Jughead were lovers.
Shut the f*** up.
It's true. Archie was the bitch and Jughead was the butch. That's why Jughead wears that crown-looking hat all the time. Be the king of Queen Archie's world.
I feel a hate crime coming on.
Oh, you know, he does have a point. I mean, Archie never did quite settle on Betty or Veronica.
Because he wanted them both at the same time, you ass. He didn't choose one because he was trying to get them both into a three-way.
Yeah.
What?
Basic girl, Archie's a sister.
Have you had conversations like this, Kevin Smith?
Have I? Yeah, I usually initiate conversations like this. I'm a big talker. I'm a big conversationalist. I'd almost rather talk than do anything else in life. And usually talk, of course, to my friends. And these are the kind of discussions that I would definitely kind of initiate with my friends. And just looking at things from a different angle, looking at them slightly askew.
Now, the scenes in Chasing Amy are really very long by today's standards.
Uh-huh.
A conversation will... I like this about the film. I mean, I see this as a good thing and even as a brave thing. But conversations last a long time. There's a song that's sung by one of the characters at a bar early on. The whole song is in the film.
Right, right.
And, you know, it strikes me that, like, you're considered, like, one of the most successful of the quote, Gen X filmmakers. And people of your generation are supposed to, according to all the cliches, just make really highly edited short scenes.
Short
as if everything was an MTV
movies.
Video. Yeah.
Right.
So it seems to me you're really going against the grain as far as what expectations are of a young filmmaker today.
I think it's just the kind of thing I like to see. I mean, I enjoy, like, the mind candy movies or the eye candy movies that are, you know, kind of like cut heavy and whatnot. But I'm more interested in dialogue. You know, I don't, you know, it's bizarre because it is a visual medium, but I go to a movie looking for dialogue. So and to me, dialogue has to, you it can't be like all choppy. It has to, if you have a scene where characters are talking about something substantial or insubstantial, you have to let that conversation build, particularly if it's a conversation that's reflecting real life. You know, you talk about stuff for hours.
Right.
I wish I could do that in film. Like, I remember once I was doing an interview with a British journalist, and they were like, they were maintaining that your movies are so dialogue heavy and so visually uninteresting that you should really think about doing radio plays. And I said, believe me, if I can get away with it, I probably would.
Mallrats is your only studio movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if the people who you work with in the studio had preconceptions of what your audience, you know, the quote Gen X audience, would want in a movie, and if they encouraged you to head in a certain direction in terms of the writing, the editing.
In terms of being encouraged in a particular direction, the only direction I was encouraged toward was away from the more salacious humor, or actually the more homoerotic humor. They didn't, that stuff made them uncomfortable, and they thought that would never play to an audience. The scene in Chasing Amy where the three principals sit around and talk about the scars they've received from, you know, from during oral sex, that was a scene originally that I had written for Mallrats, and Universal, the studio, was just like, you know what, this isn't going to play. This scene will, you know, it'll offend everybody. And I said, that's fine, I'll take it and put, you know, I never throw anything out. I put it in a drawer, and I'm like, I'm sure this will pop up handy in some other movie. And lo and behold, then it became a scene in Mallrats. It was a scene between three guys, and Chasing Amy becomes a scene between two guys and a girl, and really between one guy and one girl. Holden's kind of left out of the conversation.
Well, meanwhile, now you're working with one of the big studios writing a script for the next Superman movie. I'm not sure if the script is completed yet or not.
Right. I was contracted to do two drafts, which I did, and now it's gone into the hands of another writer. You know, there's never one writer on these movies in Hollywood. But yeah, I worked for the Warner Brothers doing that and had a blast, had a great time, particularly because, you know, I'm such a comic book fan.
Right. Well, you know, even in I guess it's Mallrats. People are sitting around talking about Superman, and they're wondering whether Lois Lane's uterus is strong enough for Superman to carry Superman's baby.
So
you must have had a lot of fun writing a Superman
script. I did. Like a lot of people, I'm sure there were serious hardcore Superman fans. We have a website. I spend a lot of time on our website, and there's a board where people post messages all the time, and I usually get on there at least once a day and answer everything that's asked. I go, you know, it doesn't matter. So there was one guy who was getting on for a short period there, probably about a week, 2 weeks, just enraged that I was writing Superman. He's like, this means Superman's going to be sitting around talking about, like, going down on women and stuff like that, you know, and talking about the size of his genitals. And, you know, it's just like, come on, give me a little credit. You know, I think I could do more than that. And, you know, and as it was when I was done with Superman, there was no racy kind of sexual humor in it whatsoever.
Your next movie is called Dogma. Tell us something about it.
It's a movie that's completely and vastly different than the three films we've done before. The three films we've done thus far have focused on relationships, right? And Clerks is a very sardonic take on relationships. Mallrats is a very idealistic movie-like take on relationships. And Chasing Amy is kind of a realistic take on relationships. This movie has nothing to do with relationships. It's all about religion and specifically organized religion, being the Catholic Church this time around. Because I grew up Catholic, so that's the one I could talk about the most. And it's a fantasy film, and it's kind of there are elements of sci-fi in it, elements of horror, it's very comedic, but very black satire, very dramatic at the same time. It's very serious. Most importantly, it's very reverent. I think a lot of people hear, like, oh, the Clerks guy is doing a religious movie. He's doing a movie about the Catholic Church and figure I'm going to thumb my nose at the church for an hour or 2 hours. And it's not the case. It's a very reverent film. And you know, it just kind of questions the idea that the good that organized religion has done over the years.
Do you still count yourself a Catholic?
No, I quit about 6 months ago, 6 to 7 months ago. I hung in there as long as I could because I always thought it was kind of hubris to change your religion. You know, I always thought that was very arrogant. I remember reading that once in the Screwtape Letters, C.S. Lewis book. One of the devils was always trying to tempt this guy into changing his religion. And you know, it was a sin of arrogance or something. So I was very scared, so I never changed my religion. But finally, I figured, you know, it's better to be somewhere that makes you feel better, you know, or feel, you know, celebratory about you know, the praise of God than the Catholic Church did. It was a shame. I would walk into Catholic Church every Sunday and they call it the celebration of the Mass, but it's no party in that place, you know. It's the people sitting around, they're there because they're afraid of going to hell, and that's it. You know, nobody's really there for love of God. They're just terrified. They don't want to burn after they die. So, and, you know, they sit there and give these lip service prayers and drone, and you know, it's not very spiritually fulfilling. So I went and joined this church called the Calvary Chapel Church, and man, you go in there and you feel a presence. You know, there is a presence in that room. And it could be 7 a.m. These people are bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. And, you know, everyone's just there, man, just enjoying the fact that we're all come together and to praise God and stuff and praise Jesus. And it's just a much better feeling, you know, than the kind of dead weight that the Catholic Church seems to have around its neck lately.
Do you have many friends who go to church?
No, heavens no. No, it's a pain in the ass to try to get somebody to go with you to church. You know? you can't convince them. Scott, my producer, will go with me before big events. I remember we went right before Sundance. We went right before Cannes. We went right before the release of Chasing Amy. We didn't go before the release of Mallrats, and look what happened. So. And he is like a devout agnostic, but he will cave and go to church with me before important events.
Kevin Smith's latest film is Chasing Amy. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, we continue our conversation with screenwriter and director Kevin Smith. Also, we talk with novelist and screenwriter Richard Russo. His new comic novel is about a professor reaching middle age on a small college campus. Russo's previous book, Nobody's Fool, was adapted into a movie starring Paul Newman. Now they're working together on a new film. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Kevin Smith. He wrote and directed the current film Chasing Amy. His first film, Clerks, was a comedy about a couple of guys who worked at a convenience store and video store. Clerks, your first film, was financed on credit cards after you dropped out of film school. Did it take a lot of courage to spend that much of your own money and believe that it wouldn't ruin your life and condemn you to eternal debt?
I never thought about it until the first time we actually screened the movie, which was at the Independent Feature Film Market, this thing that the IFP, the Independent Feature Project, sponsors every year in Manhattan at the Angelica Theaters. But you pay $500, you stick your film into this marketplace, and you get a screening slot, and you try to pack the screening with as many potential distributors or you know, investors as possible. Well, nobody showed up for our screening, except basically the cast and crew, and with the exception of a few stragglers, including this one very important guy named Bob Hawke, who started the ball rolling on the whole experience. But it was in that screening, in the first 10 minutes of that screening, that I cringed, you know, and I just broke inside, and I was like, I can't believe I made this movie. I can't, God, why is everyone speaking like that? Everyone's talking so damn dirty. I was like, oh, God, I have $27,000 in debt. And then after another half hour of watching the movie, I said, well, you know, it's kind of like 1 year of film school. So I'll just pay off the debt, and, you know, if I still feel like making movies after that, I'll try it again. You know, it's only money.
Clerks was shot in a convenience store, and it's about a couple of guys working in a convenience store who also work in a video store. You were working in a convenience store, I think, while or before you made the movie. Did you shoot it in the store you actually worked in?
Yeah, in both of those stores. The owner owned both the convenience store and the video store, Mr. Topper and Mrs. Topper, great, great people. But they owned both of those stores, and that's where I'd worked for about 2 or 3 years by that time. And I'd worked in convenience stores in general for a long time, but that was the final one, and that was the one where it kind of all came together. And when I decided that I wanted to be a filmmaker, I was like, well, why don't I make a movie about this stuff? I mean, I've been doing it long enough. After 6-7 years, you have to have enough material for at least 90 minutes. You know what I'm saying? So yeah, I shot it in both the stores I used to work in.
Hmm. What was the kind of customer who most irritated you in the years that you worked at convenience stores?
I'll tell you, I know that question so well, I know the answer so well, because it still bothers me to death. And I consciously avoid the behavior I'm about to describe. It is the person who will slap money down on a counter and not hand it to you.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
It makes all the difference, man, to just hand you a dollar bill rather than put it on a counter, or even worse, change. Throw down 75 cents, and they're waiting for change for something. But they'll lay it on the counter as opposed to hand it to you. And I was a firm believer in, like, you know, do unto others. So people would do that to me, and I'd put their change on the counter. They'd hold their hand open, I'd put their change on the counter, and people would get so pissed off. I mean, people still, I'm sure I'm reviled in the town of Leonardo, where those two stores were, because I was a pretty bitter convenience store employee. And really, I just got back what I got, you know, what I was given, which isn't a very Christian way of operating the store, but what the heck, you know. But that and the people that would all, you know, that would go through that penny thing, you know, leave a penny, take a penny.
Yeah.
You know, go through it for like 25 cents, you know, like collect all the pennies and pay for something, you know, come in with no money and actually buy something with those pennies. Or the guy who'll, you know, something is $1, $1.03, and he has a $20 bill and he takes 3 pennies out. You know, it's like, dude, you obviously have the pennies. You know, you don't need 3 pennies from the jar. You're not hurting for cash.
Did you ever get robbed in the years that you worked in convenience stores?
No, never, never. There's always scares around Halloween when you work in convenience stores. They always tell you to be careful on Halloween because everyone's wearing masks anyway. And usually that's when bandits, robbers, whatever, like to come in, you know, because they can walk into the store, you know, unnoticed, you know, or not, they wouldn't, you can't see them on the street and immediately freak out like there's a robber coming, you know, because everyone's wearing masks anyway on Halloween. But it never happened to us. It happened to one of the sister stores kind of up north more, but never to us, and or never to any store I ever worked in. And there was actually the original ending to Clerks was a guy coming in, robbing the store, and shooting Dante, killing Dante, and actually taking money out of the register. And we shot that ending and cut it off before we went to Sundance, thank God.
Why did you change it?
John Pearson, really good friend of mine. John Pearson, guy wrote Spike, Mike, Slackers, and Dykes. He's an independent film representative guru, czar, a lot of people have called him. And he said, look, you have a very funny movie here, a great movie, you know, with a lot of goodwill in it, and you grow to love these characters over 90 minutes, you know, 90 to 100 minutes. You can't kill the main character off in the end. You know, it's just not right. It's unfair. The audience will rise up and slay you. And, you know, he asked me, he's like, why did you want to do that? And I said, well, I mean, I wanted to make an independent film. That's what happens in independent film. Someone always gets shot. And John was like, well, you have no message here. I mean, I fancied myself Spike Lee. Do the Right Thing was one of my favorite movies. And it's like a very funny movie through most of the time. And then in the last half hour, it turns very serious. And I really fancied, like, Clerks, kind of like that. You know, it's set in the one block radius. All takes place in a day. It's very funny. At the end, I was trying to turn serious and kind of have a message to say, well, Spike Lee has a zillion messages. I have none. So it didn't really pan out for me. So I just cut that ending off.
Now, you've said that you grew up on, like, 80s youth comedies, like the John Hughes movies. I think the first independent film that you saw was Slacker.
Yep, which, Richard Linklater's Slacker.
Yeah, which came out, what, 5 years ago or something like that?
It came out, God, what was it, 89? Yeah. 89 or 90.
So what impact 91. Did that have on you, seeing a movie that wasn't...
91, I'm sorry, it came out in 91.
What impact did that have on you?
A huge impact. I saw it on my 21st birthday, and it suddenly, everything clicked, the stars aligned. And I was a guy who really didn't know what he was going to do with his life. I figured I'd own a deli one day, maybe. But seeing Slacker really opened it up for me, because I was like, here's this guy from, like, where? Austin, Texas? What's that? And, you know, he's made a movie. And this movie isn't like any movie I've ever seen before. There's really no plot going on. There's just a lot of characters, and characters come and go, and there's a lot of dialogue, and there's a lot of esoteric dialogue. And, you know, and I was sitting in an audience surrounded by people, and these people were finding it funny, you know, more funny than even I found it. I found it funny or amusing, but these people were laughing out loud. And I think it comes down to you view things like that with a mix of awe and arrogance. You're like, I can't believe this movie's that great. But at the same time, you're like, I can do this. You know, like, I've discovered something wonderful, but I can do this. I mean, why can't I do that? If he can do it in Austin, Texas, why can't I do it in Highlands, New Jersey, or Leonardo, New Jersey, or whatever? So, you know, and as I sat there listening to people laugh, I was like, I'll give him something really funny to laugh at. So that's how it kind of came together. It was an epiphany of sorts.
Well, Kevin Smith, thank you very much for talking with us.
No, thank you. Thanks for having me on. It was a pleasure.
Kevin Smith's current film, Chasing Amy, is currently in theaters. His films Clerks and Mallrats are on video. Coming up, screenwriter and novelist Richard Russo. This is Fresh Air. In the new comic novel Straight Man, William Henry Devereaux Jr. is facing middle age as the chairman of the English department on a small college campus utterly lacking in prestige. My guest is the author, Richard Russo. Academic life is a new subject for him. His previous novels, Mohawk, Risk Pool, and Nobody's Fool, were about life for the working class and unemployed in a fictional small town in upstate New York, a town based on the one he grew up in. Nobody's Fool was adapted into a movie starring Paul Newman. Here's a reading from the prologue of the new novel, Straight Man, in which Devereaux is thinking back on his childhood, his relationship with his father, and the day his dog died and was buried by Devereaux's father. The father was a very successful academic and literary theorist.
In the years after he left us, my father became even more famous. He is sometimes credited, if credit is the word, with being the father of American literary theory. In addition to his many books of scholarship, he's also written a literary memoir that was shortlisted for a major award and that offers insight into the personalities of several major literary figures of the 20th century, now deceased. His photograph often graces the pages of the literary reviews. He went through a phase where he wore crewneck sweaters and gold chains beneath his tweed coat, but now he's mostly photographed in an Oxford button-down shirt, tie, and jacket in his book-lined office at the university. But to me, his son, William Henry Devereaux Sr. is most real standing in his ruined Cordovan loafers, leaning on the handle of a borrowed shovel, examining his dirty, blistered hands and receiving my suggestion of what to name a dead dog. I suspect that digging our dog's grave was one of the relatively few experiences of his life, excepting carnal ones that did not originate on the printed page. And when I suggested we name the dead dog Red, he looked at me as if I had just stepped from the pages of a book that he had started to read years ago and then put down when something else caught his interest. What? He said, letting go of the shovel so that its handle hit the earth between my feet. What? It's not an easy time for any parent, this moment when the realization dawns on you that you have given birth to something that will never see things the way you do, despite the fact that it is your living legacy, that it bears your name.
That's Richard Russo reading from his new novel, Straight Man. You know, it's interesting, your previous books have been about fathers who are working class or out of work, people who do manual labor. And in this new book, the father is the father of literary theory. He's an academic father, someone who's experienced everything as filtered through the page. I'm wondering if you started comparing in your mind the frustrations of having a father who was out of work a lot to the frustrations of having a father who's a star in the academic field and is also incredibly self-absorbed.
Right. I mean, what of course, the fathers in the earlier books and this father have in common is that they are not there for the boy in question. William Henry Devereux Sr. is not only going to leave, but he's not really there, even in the beginning of this book, when he is there. I mean, he's there, he's living in the family, he's there at the dinner table. But in some important way, he's absent. He is self-absorbed, but he's also absorbed in language, in the word, in the life of the mind. And I think he's the kind of man for whom a child isn't really going to be all that interested until the child probably gets older and can approach him on the same plane that he's used to being approached by students and fellow faculty members. And of course, by the time a kid gets that old, probably the things he's going to have to say to such a father will be the kinds of things that no father wants to hear.
In your early novels, you drew a lot on your relationship with your father, who you never lived with because your parents separated when you were very young.
Yeah.
And, your father, it sounds from your fiction, must have been an eccentric, a bit of a drunk, a bit of a con man, but very lovable in his own way. I'm wondering if when he died a few years ago, if your reactions to the loss surprised you.
No, my very profound reaction to my father's loss was not something by that time that surprised me. My father and I became very close, and since both Sam Hall and Donald Sullivan are written large, I'm afraid that people might get the wrong impression about my own father, that he was perhaps more of a rogue than he actually was in real life. He was a man who played an enormous part, sometimes just by his absence, in my own imagination as a child. By the time that I was in college and returning home in the summers to work road construction with him, he had begun to play an even larger role in my life and in my imagination. And by the time he fell ill when I was writing The Risk Pool, he and I had become very close. And it did not take me entirely by surprise how much that I was going to miss him, the ways in which I would continue to see him and think about him and think in terms of him for the decade or so that it's been.
In a previous novel, you wrote about the small upstate New York town the characters lived in. Everyone lived pretty near the edge of unemployment, of lunacy, of bankruptcy, of potentially hazardous ignorance, of despair. And hence the local custom was that you only worried about people nearest the brink. Otherwise, you'd worry yourself over the edge. Did you used to assume that with education and with money and with employment, that despair goes away?
I'm not so sure that I thought that exactly. And I think, for me, Straight Man is as I think your question is angling at, is about a different kind of despair entirely. As a matter of fact, it's a despair at the very other end of the spectrum. I think Hank Devereux in this novel, Lucky Hank as he is known to his friends and enemies alike, is a man who has done an awful lot of what he wanted to do in life. He has built the house that he wanted to build. He has become a tenured full professor at perhaps not the academic institution that he imagined himself at, but he has been promoted to a point where he can't go anywhere else. He has married the woman that he wants to marry and that he is perhaps even more deeply in love with than he realizes during the book. He has children who have grown up healthy and well. He has, in a kind of metaphorical sense, he has a kind of tenure in life. And it's the very sense of this kind of tenure in life, of the fact that things are going well and may continue to go well, and the fact that his story, as it were, if he looks at his own life as a story, he can kind of sense where it's going. And I think that's what, when people begin to sense that they know exactly where their life is going, that they've made most of their decisions in life that are going to be of consequence, and now what you're doing is sitting back and waiting for all of these choices that you've made to kind of play themselves out, a new and very different and very virulent kind of despair begins to set in when you sense that your story is nearing its conclusion and that most of the interesting choices that you had are the choices that you've already made and are now looking back on.
Now, why did you choose that as a theme?
I suppose that there are autobiographical reasons to write a book like that. I feel incredibly blessed in my own life. I'm doing, you know, by some almost miraculous happenstance, I seem to be doing exactly what I want to do at this point. I tell stories, which is a very enjoyable thing for me to do. I have a wonderful family, but there's a sense that you get that everybody, I think, in middle age gets. I think this is really a novel about middle age, of having a lot of happiness, a lot of if you're lucky enough to have had some success, to be very pleased with what you've done. But Hank is the kind of man who would dearly love to start over, just to be at the beginning of something again, as opposed to the middle or the middle towards the end. Because one of the things that you know when you get to be middle age is that you're not going to start again.
You taught for 24 years and retired from full-time teaching a couple of years ago. Why did you leave?
Well, there were a couple of reasons. Like most middle-aged people, we begin to hear the clock ticking. I don't know how many more novels I've got in me, but I wanted to make sure that whatever amount of time I have, that I won't leave any books unwritten that I've got in me. And you know, when you start pushing 50, you begin to realize that there just isn't an infinite amount of time, and you begin to think about how you might spend your time as wisely as you possibly can. And also another reason, almost as important, was that most teachers begin to feel after they've been teaching for 20 years or so, even if you believe what you're teaching and what you're saying to students, after you've said it for about the 100th time, you begin to be aware of not only just being awfully tired of repeating yourself, but you also become aware of all the things that you don't know, you yourself don't know. And as I continue to write, I become more and more aware of the gigantic ignorance that I'm laboring under. There are things that I need to know about medicine, about law, about real estate, about art, about all sorts of things that I would be wise to learn something about, since I seem to be casting characters who are in some of those professions, and not being a full-time academic has freed me to become a much wider and much more voracious reader. And instead of, you know, imparting for the umpteenth time what little I do know, kind of supplementing what I know with some other things that I badly need to know.
My guest is Richard Russo. His new novel is called Straight Man. We'll talk more in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Back with Richard Russo, his new comic novel, Straight Man, is set on a college campus. His previous novels, Mohawk, The Risk Pool, and Nobody's Fool, were set in a working-class town in upstate New York. So we've established that your fiction has been set in two worlds that you've lived in, the world of the blue-collar small town and the world of the campus. But you've done some work in a third world, which is the world of Hollywood, the world of the celebrity class and the Hollywood executive for the movie Nobody's Fool. How closely did you work on that, and how involved did you get in that world?
Well, actually, I've become more involved with it since then. I've just finished writing a screenplay of Straight Man, and Robert Benton, who directed Nobody's Fool, and I have collaborated on another project that just finished filming. So I have, in working on Nobody's Fool, I really did script work that began only after the movie had begun its shooting. And so I kind of tiptoed in the back door on that project, did a little bit of screen work, made a very good friend in Robert Benton, who wanted to work with me on another project. And so now I'm involved on a third, and it's a new thing. It's been kind of fun.
What was it like for you to see Paul Newman playing one of the father characters in Nobody's Fool? I mean, the father character in Nobody's Fool.
Right, right. It was a little unnerving at first. He was, I mean, Paul Newman is an icon. He was too good looking. The baggage that it seemed to me that he brought to that role, and that I didn't think he was ever going to be able to get rid of, was the baggage of just being Paul Newman. I think that he has a kind of history as an icon that makes it impossible for you to dislike him, even when he's doing horrible things. You cast him in the most villainous role, as he had a villainous role in one of the Coen brothers' recent Coen brothers movies, and you like him. You just cannot help but like him. He's got that kind of history that trails him. And my worst fear was that in Nobody's Fool, in the movie, that we were never going to get the sense of Sully as a dangerous man, a man who could be dangerous to his family, a man who could be dangerous to anyone who gets too close to him. And I was very afraid that Paul Newman would not be able to convey that sense of what a dangerous man Sully was. And I think that Paul did remarkably well in that role, given the fact that he is an icon. I think that his rendition of My Donald Sullivan is probably more immediately likable than Sully was in my novel. But I thought his performance was utterly compelling, and I found myself, after just a very short period of time, getting into the spirit of his notion of this man, and I thought it was terrific.
I'm wondering if your compass works for you when you're working in movies. If your sense of what's funny translates, if your sense of what an interesting story is translates, of what's entertaining, if that translates.
I don't know. I mean, we're just the second film that Robert Benton and I wrote together is being screened right now, it's at that point that you were
test screening. Test
yeah, screenings? It's test screenings, and it's always interesting to sit in a theater with 80 or 90 people who are coming into a movie in a way that nobody actually goes into a movie for test screenings. Nobody knows what the movie's going to be about. They don't know who's in it. They don't know what kind of movie it is. Whereas in real life, really what happens is when you go to see a movie, you've seen so many trailers for it, you've seen it advertised on television. When you go into a movie, you are going to see the movie that you've already been prepared to see.
Who's in the movie that's being screened now, and what's it about?
Oh, it has a wonderful cast. It's an odd movie in some ways. I think it's a detective story, and it's set in Los Angeles. But the mystery elements of the story are not as important as the character elements. And rather than giving the audience 8 or 10 characters to choose from as to who the murderer is. You get to choose between 3 or 4, and you don't want to believe really that it's any of them. It's a very character-oriented piece, and the actors who are in it are just uniformly wonderful. Paul Newman plays the detective in the movie, and the other major players are Susan Sarandon and Gene Hackman and James Garner.
Interesting cast.
Yeah.
They're
all terrific.
You getting to work with them directly?
Actually, after the script, I think that's why fax machines were invented.
So that
movie stars don't have to deal directly with writers and vice versa. So I've been happily working away at Central Maine, putting words on a page, and you know, lo and behold, a year later, I'm hearing, you know, Gene Hackman repeat them to me.
Well, Richard Russo, I wish you good luck with your books and your movies. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Richard Russo's new novel is called Straight Man. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Bob Purdick, Joyce Lieberman, Bob Alls, Al Banks, and Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan Tu directed today's show. I'm Jerry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
There's a new biography of Louis Armstrong. On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk with the author, Lawrence Berggren. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.